we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
In recognising a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it.
The information war over Syria has taken a vicious turn, with dissenting voices now facing furious attacks from UK mainstream media.
There have been accusations over the last few days that some of the mainstream media have been launching somewhat of a McCarthyite witch hunt against those who have been questioning the overriding narrative with regard to Syria. There's been an article written in the Times newspaper which basically targeted a number of academics and people working at the various universities in the country who have been questioning not just this latest attack on Syria, but the government's policy for the last 7 years.
Last week, Senator McCarthy appeared on this program to correct any errors he might have thought we made in our report of March 9th. Since he made no reference to any statements of fact that we made, we must conclude that he found no errors of fact. He proved again that anyone who exposes him, anyone who does not share his hysterical disregard for decency and human dignity and the rights guaranteed by the Constitution must be either a communist or a fellow traveller.
It was the giant of the Labour left, Tony Benn, who said that every generation must fight the same battles. Confronted, as we are, once again by the vicious beast of McCarthyism, Tony Benn was right. There is no more foul a stench than the stench of hypocrisy. And there is no more foully hypocrisy than an ideologically driven campaign to silence and smear dissenting political and academic voices in the cause of democracy. Whereas the original incarnation of McCarthyism in the 1950s, along with its predecessor, the House Un-American Activities of the 1940s, was confined to the United States, its current incarnation is centred in the UK, a country in which many of the original victims of the Red Scare in America sought and found sanctuary. Speaking as a British citizen, I refuse to accept for a second that my association with Russian media is any less legitimate than my association with the BBC or the Guardian newspaper has been when my work as a freelance journalist and writer has appeared there. I refuse to accept there is anything illegitimate about Russian media. On the contrary, it plays an invaluable and indispensable role in providing a desperately needed platform for dissenting voices on a range of issues, most emphatically Western foreign policy in a time of unending conflict and chaos. And it is precisely because Russian media provides this platform that it has come under such a concerted and determined attack both in the US and the UK. A nation of sheep will beget a government of wolves, the great American journalist Edward R. Murrow said, and just as he and other giants such as Paul Robeson and Arthur Miller stood up to and defied McCarthyism in their time, so must we stand up to and defy it in ours. And just in case anyone thinks I'm exaggerating on this, the fact that the Murdoch-owned London Times newspaper ran a front page with the headline "Apologists for Assad Working in British Universities," this surely leaves no doubt of just how deep this neo-McCarthyite swamp in Britain has reached. The Times article lists a group of academics in the UK who have dared challenge the British government's narrative on the Skripal poisoning, on the role of the White Helmets in Syria, and on the alleged chemical weapons attacks that have taken place in Syria and been attributed to Syrian government forces. The Times has gone from once bearing the proud mantle of Britain's newspaper of record to being nothing more than the in-house periodical of the neocon Henry Jackson Society. And these people have the gall to decry the lack of diversity on Russian media? You couldn't make it up. Not satisfied with this attack piece, though, a campaign is now underway to have the academics targeted sacked from the various universities at which they are employed. In light of the recrudescence of this McCarthyite poison, the question now is, who will stand? Who will refuse to be cowed and do as those great figures that I mentioned, Paul Robeson, Arthur Miller, Edward R. Murrow did, and say no? In words that deserve to be carved in stone, Robeson said, "Every artist, every scientist must decide now where he stands. He has no alternative. There is no standing above the conflict on Olympian Heights. There are no impartial observers. Through the destruction, in certain countries of the greatest of man's literary heritage, through the propagation of false ideas of racial and national superiority, the artist, the scientist, the writer is challenged. The struggle invades the formerly cloistered halls of our universities and other seats of learning. The battlefront is everywhere. There is no sheltered rear." End quote. The time, my friends, has come to witch hunt the witch hunters. I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Well, who better to discuss this issue in depth than one of the academics who's been targeted? Tara McCormack is a lecturer in international relations, specialising in security, foreign policy, and democratic legitimacy. Tara, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Now, I mentioned the London Times article. You are targeted in this article, or you are targeted in this article, because emanating from this article is, as I say, a campaign to have you and your fellow academics, I would think it's fair to say, sacked from your positions at the various universities at which you work. What is their problem with the work that you've been doing, Tara? And indeed, what is the work? It's part of your grouping, the Working Group on Syria, I believe.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the ironies of the whole thing is that the Working Group hasn't done any academic work yet. So we have, you know, started the group. We've been talking about what to do. We'll think about maybe going for some research funding. Academics know how that all works. But we haven't actually started on our research projects yet. So it's quite extraordinary that you have this Times article, front page of the Times, double spread inside, editorial, on the day that Britain, France and the UK launch illegal airstrikes.
That is absolutely key to this entire thing.
You couldn't make it up, really. You'd think maybe the Times might think there are other things to cover at this in that, you know, last weekend. But so we haven't actually done any academic work yet. So this is the extraordinary thing. So the article itself, in as far, you know, I forced myself to read it just because really life is too short to read that sort of bilge. But the article itself is an astonishing, it's an astonishingly kind of weak hatchet job.
Yes.
You know, so I was joking with friends the other day, you know, I can't even be the victim of a good hatchet job. I mean, it's so weak. So really it focuses a lot on my colleague, Tim Hayward, Professor Hayward at University of Edinburgh. And literally all it is picking up on things that Tim has tweeted and retweeted, you know, points of interest. Obviously, we all know, you know, people retweet things as
Tara, if I could just interject, I think it's important to establish at this point that we are not talking about a group of avowed conspiracy theorists here. We're talking about a group of distinguished academics, professors and PhDs. I mean, this just adds an extra layer of surreality to the issue, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, also, one of the, you know, interest, the attack, so because we haven't actually done any work, and it will be, work that we do will be continuing on from, Professor Piers Robinson of Sheffield's great work on organised persuasive political communication, as it's called these days, propaganda. Particularly in times of war, Piers has done amazing, you know, academic work on the Iraq War, the CNN effect. He's well known for that. So we haven't actually done any academic work to criticise. So the article just focused really on tweets. I mean, it was absolutely astonishing. I'm sure people will have seen the kind of risible Corbyn's Factory of Hate, which was another Times blockbuster scandal from a couple of weeks ago, you know, where they basically sent journalists trawling through Facebook groups to try and find something bad that someone had said. And of course they did. But what did that have to do with Corbyn? So it was a very similar in that actually content wise, there's literally nothing there. And of course, also in terms of all of us. You know, there's a vast difference between things that you might tweet and say, hey, this is interesting, or, you know, this raises questions, or what, or whatever. And then academic work, you know, I personally do I've been doing a fair bit of media on the Skripal case. You know, I write opinion pieces, and that's obviously very different as well from actual academic research. So, yeah, the content of the Hatchet job is actually ridiculous. You know, I mean, it's always...
We're really talking the totalitarianism of ideas. And looking at the Times, the Rupert Murdoch-owned London Times newspaper, owned by a man who plays such a malign role in our democracy and politics. Indeed, he refutes his status and his position in our society and calls into question the whole subject of media ownership. The idea that we have a free press in the West, certainly in the UK, is just preposterous, given the clutch of billionaires, all of them right-wing reactionaries who own 99.9% of our media and who wield it as a sword not to hold the powerful to account, as is the role of the Fourth Estate in a free society, but to attack the powerless and those who dare dissent from received truths when it comes to foreign policy. Here's my gambit, Tara. It's not so much dissent that they can't deal with. It's the fact that dissent nowadays has a platform that it never had before in which to be expressed. I'm talking about social and alternative media. And thus it is much harder for them to be able to sheepify, to coin a neologism, sheepify people who are now able to access not different facts per se, but different analyses as to the meaning behind the facts. Would you agree with me on that?
Well, I think there are a lot of issues that you've raised there. I mean, you know, there are certainly issues of media ownership and the way that the media works. But I would also like to point out that, just out of interest, for example, Sky News has had a very different approach, actually, to the Times. You know, I've seen a surprising number, you know, it's not as I would present things, but I've seen a surprising number of interviews. Sky has, you know, made more of an effort, certainly much more than the BBC and the Times, which is just full on, you know, preposterous. You know, so I think there are complex discussion.
Well, I will give on that, because if I think of George Galloway, my colleague, he presents a very popular show on talk radio, which is also owned by Rupert Murdoch, and his show is far from adhering to the prevailing orthodoxy. So there are slivers of light, shall we say, amid the darkness. But I wonder if the Times problem is its association with the aforementioned Henry Jackson Society. Indeed, we know that prominent columnists at the Times newspaper enjoy a symbiotic, it's fair to say, relationship with this neocon think tank.
Yes, I mean, I have nothing positive to say about the Henry Jackson Society at all. But, you know, so there are questions about media. So I think you, in some, Sky, for example, has been much more open, which has been really interesting. But on your sort of final point about social media, I mean, yeah, I think it is true. There's been... The rise of social media has allowed people to discuss things, to share articles. You know, we can have online platforms, for example, that will receive a lot of readership. You know, so in some ways there are kind of negative aspects to it as well. We do definitely see a kind of flourishing, I guess, more on the internet. But I mean, I think one of the interesting things for me as well about what this whole episode has revealed is, and this is something that's again been understood and discussed in kind of academic work, there's a real gap between a lot of the media and the readership. Like a lot of the mainstream media doesn't really reflect what people think.
Okay, please hold that thought, Tara. We've come up to the break, I'm afraid. You're listening to Tara McCormack. This is Hard Facts. We'll be right back.
We have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard Facts.
Welcome back to the second half of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down in the company of Tara McCormack, lecturer in international relations, and we are discussing the eruption, and that is what it is, eruption of a neo-McCarthyite campaign centred not in the US as it was in the 1950s, but here in the UK. So Tara, sorry, you were going on about social media and the role of how social media has changed that helped to shape the scepticism that is undoubtedly a feature of our society today. I would contend on the back of the war in Iraq and the disasters that have ensued from that war, which was entered into, as everyone knows, on the basis of fabricated and concocted intelligence.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the things that, you know, when I'm doing my sort of media discussions on both Skripal and Syria, that's one of the points that I'm just banging on about, you know, Chilcot and Iraq. And one of the problems is that's often just, oh, well, that was then. You know, no. The point about Chilcot is not, Chilcot isn't a kind of historical overview. Chilcot is about now.
And it's been swept under the carpet. I mean, came and went in about a week.
Yeah, and it's Chilcot, but we can look at the House of Lords Foreign Affairs Committee report on Libya 2016, which again, you know, it's from the House of Commons, not House of Lords. It's a really hard-hitting piece in which it's very clear, and the Foreign Affairs Committee doesn't really pull many punches, that Cameron essentially fabricated a case for intervention in Libya. So absolutely, it's been both kind of events have been swept under the carpet. And of course, one can look at, you know, the absolutely kind of established fact of the role of Britain, mainly of America, Turkey, Saudi in, you know, basically funding a covert war against the Syrian government for 7 years, you know, billions of dollars poured in to the most horrific Islamist groups.
Who have been depicted as Jeffersonian Democrats and romantic rebels, whereas the Syrian Arab Army has been depicted as a latter-day Waffen-SS in the mainstream media.
Absolutely, like, you know, as if it's kind of Tunbridge Wells or something. No, absolutely. I mean, and all this is omitted. You know, so there's a lot that is omitted as well, which is also an important part of framing the media narrative.
Now, Tara, a great hero of mine is Arthur Miller. A man who I consider to be a moral giant, one of the moral giants of the 20th century, as well as a fantastic playwright and supreme artist. And he wrote an essay which I thought was very interesting on his experience of the McCarthyite period in which he was ensnared and famously refused to testify. And he writes, and I quote, "The paranoid's job is to unmask and disarm, to find the seemingly innocent traces of the pervading malevolence. His only hope is power. Power to neutralise the dangers around him. Naturally, since those dangers can be anywhere, his power must also be total in order to work." End quote. Now, Miller attributes the McCarthyite period to the politics of paranoia. But I think we have to ask, where does this paranoia come from? It doesn't just come from anywhere. And here's my gambit. It is because the people who are prosecuting this McCarthyite campaign are the people who benefit from the status quo of injustice in our time. The unending inequality, neoliberalism, the free market, people who work in the city or who are connected to the city or who occupy these sinecures in these very lucrative newspaper columns at the Times and other newspapers and establishment press. And so any dissent is a threat to that status quo and thereby a threat to their personal position and status. Do you see where I'm going with that, Tara?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think obviously it is certainly quite difficult at the moment. And I imagine people do people may feel reluctant to stand up and say, you know, well, no, hey, where's the evidence? What's going on here? Because it's not just in the Times. But, you know, there is quite a strong mood of if you criticise the government, you know, you must be working for the Kremlin. But there's an extraordinary interview, BBC interview of Admiral Lord West, you know.
Yes.
Who I think would be pushing it to say is an Assad apologist. But, hey, I imagine Alan Mendoza could go there.
Alan Mendoza being a director general, I believe, of the Henry Jackson Society.
Sorry. You know, but astonishing interview where the BBC interviewer says, yes, well, to Lord West, who's expressing skepticism about the who committed the chemical attack, as indeed has Lord Shaw, another senior military figure. And the interviewer says to him, well, you know, aren't you just muddying the waters? I think it's a sort of jaw-dropping moment. But, I mean, on the positive side, you know, there are a handful of people who are standing up. Peter Oborne, for example, Peter Hitchens, you know, people from different sides of the political spectrum.
Craig Murray, former UK ambassador to Uzbekistan, has been widely maligned for daring to question very, very effectively, by the way, the prevailing narrative on the Skripal poisoning.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so there are, and sort of amazingly, you know, Lord West and Lord Shaw, both of whom have made a point of saying, well...
Let's be honest, Tara, the wheels are coming off their narrative when it comes to Syria and incidents such as the Skripal poisoning. As I have said before, per Karl Marx, they are like sorcerers who are no longer able to control the powers of the netherworld that they have called up by their spells. They don't know what to do about all this scepticism. Everything they say now is being met, is being challenged and contested because of this platform, and also because of the awakening of a large minority of the population based on Iraq, based on what they're experiencing, the injustice at home, the foreign policy, how it's only helping to deepen the crises that it's meant to solve and resolve, terrorism, the unending conflicts, the tension with Russia, on and on and on. They must think we're really stupid. And this goes back to the role of these neocon think tanks. The Henry Jackson Society is central, the Atlantic Council, Stratfor. There's a whole litany of these think tanks. They wield so much influence. I think it's fair to say that, in essence, our foreign policy mirrors their ideology almost to a T.
I mean, I think that genuinely, that is a very serious problem, that issue of the absence of trust. And too often, I think that is framed as an issue of fake news. You know, people are just idiots because they're being fed all this propaganda from the Kremlin or wherever. But it's not that at all. It is a genuine kind of gap. And this has been looked at a lot in political theory. There's a lot of really good academic work. You know, there's a kind of growing gap between the people and the elites, and it comes out in various ways. Brexit, for example, is an interesting example of that. You know, so there is a genuine sense of distrust. And I don't know so much that social media creates it, but rather the success...
No, it helps to channel it.
It helps to channel it. And people turn to alternative sources because they no longer particularly trust the media, you know, and that's also reflected, for example, look at the print media, the kind of falling readership of the print media. And as the print media and the mainstream media less and less kind of reflects what people think, obviously people turn away from it. So it's quite, there's a whole kind of complex number of, you know, social trends, I think, going on. And it is certainly true, to go back to Iraq, that I, you know, in Britain, in America, for example, the majority of people do not want to engage in military intervention, and that's obviously a problem for...
Well, that's a key plank of the foreign policy.
Exactly.
Neoconservatism. Yeah, regime change wars.
That's it, and that's obviously a problem for political elites at the moment. That actually there's widespread skepticism, completely correct, you know, completely right. You know, we know that just before the strikes in Syria, several polls were conducted that showed a majority of people didn't support the bombing.
Only 22% were in favour, according to YouGov.
That's right, even if chemical weapons use was proved.
And that's despite the weight of a media campaign to curry support for that airstrike, painting Assad as a monster, and the war atrocity porn that was prevalent on our TV screens during this period.
The whole background of kind of Russophobia. So I was actually really heartened when I saw that. I thought, wow, you know, and it just goes to show you as well, you know, even after years of kind of a very, very quite strong...
Well, it's a case of fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me, isn't it? Now, can I move on to the actual particulars of the work that you and your fellow academics are doing under the auspices of this working group on Syria? Tell us a bit about that, please.
Well, Well, the thing is, we haven't started yet. We haven't done anything. At the moment, we're just kind of thinking about sources, thinking about where to go. You know, so it's going to look at...
So what's the objective, though? What is the plan?
The plan is to look at how the media presents the war in Syria, you know, kind of questioning a lot of the presentation, kind of fairly, you know, just fairly straightforward media analysis. But as I said, we haven't begun anything yet, which, to go back to the beginning, which is just what's quite extraordinary about the Times. You know, not only is it probably unprecedented that the Times front page, double page spread and leader is attempting to kind of quash about a few academics. We haven't even done any academic work for them to...
And how's your university responded to this, Tara? I take it they're giving you full support?
Yeah, I mean, I know that both Sheffield and Edinburgh have, you know, both said it's an academic freedom matter, and so too has my department. It hasn't, you know, at the moment, thankfully, it doesn't seem to be an issue. I mean, I think if you read the Times article, it would be hard actually to make any kind of case for anything. Do you see what I mean? Because it's so weak that it would actually be difficult to say.
Supposition, based on nothing more than supposition.
Well, based on literally nothing but, you know, retweets. So it isn't even that they could be saying, oh, look at this terrible piece of work, because it doesn't exist. And any work that is done is not going to be, you know, the equivalent of a tweet or an opinion piece, you know, because that's obviously the difference between a leader comment or an op-ed, you know, or a blog post.
And Tara, can I ask, will this campaign in any way divert you from your objectives? Will it in any way blunt your determination to continue your work?
No, absolutely not. You know, I was really shocked for about 2 days, and then I just became furious. You know, it absolutely won't. It just made me realise actually how important it is to, you know, just get it, have a thick skin and carry on doing media, you know, and doing academic work looking at this kind of thing. It just makes me realise, it actually made me realise, no, you know, this is a really significant thing that needs, you know, and we need to kind of keep on and start doing some work to give the Times real ammunition.
Well, I mentioned the great Edward R. Murrow in my introduction, and his quote, "A nation of sheep will beget a government of wolves." And given the scepticism that we've identified in society when it comes to their unending regime change wars, though we may have a government of wolves, we are yet to become a nation of sheep. You've been listening to Tara McCormick. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.